Bhagavad Gita, and the conflict inside where the individual is torn between two values, you see, and he is not able to decide which one to accept. That is the merit of the Gita, that it addresses itself to a situation in life, one, and then it gives a practical guidance of how to come to a decision in a crisis, psychological crisis like that, and how also to turn all action into a means of spiritual growth. That is the basis on which we have been working, is it not? That action being three-fourths of man's activity, if action is ruled out of spiritual life, then spiritual life will become poor. That is, it will be meant only for a microscopic minority, and it will have no significance to humanity as a whole. If in any scheme of divine perfection or spiritual life, action is ruled out as always bound to be imperfect, and action always binding on man and result of man's ignorance and so on, then three-fourths of man's activity will have to be left out, because action is three-fourths of life in man's life, you see. And that is the greatest merit of the Gita, greatest contribution to man's growth and to true spirituality, that it includes, not only include, but it insists on action or works as a means for spiritual growth. It is not all action automatically spiritual, that it always says like that, that whenever a man acts, it doesn't mean that he is acting for spirituality. Man ordinarily acts under the drive of desire, or impulse of ego, or greed, or selfishness, and so on. Well, those are the actions that really limit the consciousness of man. But it is possible to utilize this very field of action in such a way that one can rise to a spiritual consciousness, even the very highest spiritual consciousness. The decision to use life as means of growth is the first necessity. Most people have an idea that spirituality or religious life is for some time. It is for half an hour, 1 hour, 2 hours at the most. Then rest of the time we have to work. So that work is never connected with spiritual life. Work is supposed to be something outside the pale of spirituality, religious life, or you know, any realization of any truth. Well, work has nothing to do. And this has been the greatest obstacle in man's progress, because this is absolutely a wrong understanding of the problem. If work is not to be admitted in spiritual life, then perfection is not possible at all. And whatever experience one may have in spiritual life, it will have no bearing on life. Until life itself is affected or influenced by spiritual consciousness, then it will have no significance for man's growth. So that the action and works have a place in life, whether one likes it or not, whether one feels attracted to it or not. There are schools of religion and schools of philosophy that always tell that action, you rule out action. Action will be always bound to be attached and bound to be egoistic and bound to lead you to mistakes, and therefore better to give up action. Well, that is a kind of philosophy which might work for 1% or, you know, less than 1% in humanity. The rest of human race is bound to act, because action is necessary. And even those who say that they do not act or do not want to act or resort to inaction, even inaction becomes action, because in order to become inactive, you have to act. There is no possibility of getting out of action. That is what Gita very categorically and positively points out, that even if you want to avoid action, you cannot avoid action. Action is indispensable even for maintenance of the body. Digestion and assimilation and circulation of blood must go on. You cannot stop it. It's work. It's action. So action is an indispensable element of man's life is first thing. And then the most important part with regard to karma yoga is that one has to decide to make action a means to reach the divine. And he has to get the technique of it, which Gita has pointed out and which you have 3/4 already discussed and finished, that you take up the action and remove desire for the result of the action from your motive. That is how you start, you see. And whenever you decide or whenever you want to do an action, you do it with the idea that you are not attached to the result. The result doesn't belong to you. That's one. And secondly, when you act, in deciding what action to accept when there is more than one alternative, well, then you resort to your highest consciousness and from there you take a decision. You do not resort to your ordinary consciousness and take a decision in Karma Yoga. If one is faced with a choice between two alternatives, it is possible for one to make a choice subject to his attachment. And it is possible for him to make a choice subject to an idealism or ethical principle. Well, in that case, he must choose by the ethical principle and not by the current social standard or idea of good and evil. That will not do. This is important because people, when they act indifferently and say that, I am doing action without desire for the fruit. That is all right. But when you do it, when a choice is presented, the decision on the part of man who chooses the action must be guided or goaded by the highest value that he has, not by the lowest value or not by the ordinary standard which have been guiding him in ordinary life. See, then one can go on the ordinary run of round and say that he is doing Karma Yoga. No, you will be presented with a choice. This is a rule of growth in inner life, that one will be presented with a choice. And in making the choice, one must choose from the highest level of his consciousness, not from current ordinary standards or from what has been accustomed to do up till now. This is important. Secondly, the desire of a result being given up, people believe or think or are afraid that there will be no motive for action. Why should one act if there is no... If desire is to be eliminated from motive of action, there will be no motive for action. Gita has supplied the motive by saying that the action must be offered to the divine. It must be your sacrifice offering to the Supreme. Every action that you do, even the most physical, yesterday I quoted that verse, you remember? Yes, even your eating and your closing and opening of the eyelids, to that extent you must go on offering to the divine. That this is my action offered to the divine. Offer it to the divine with the sincerity from the heart. Well, then that action will become a step to lead the consciousness in direct communication with the divine consciousness. It establishes a bridge. One says, how do I know that my action has reached the divine or my sacrifice has been accepted by the divine? This is a common doubt of the age in which we are living. It is due to a stupid atmosphere of ignorance which is all around us, which does not allow us to understand even the ABC of what is divine. If you understand that, if you say there is God, then there is always three attributes that go with God: omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence. How could it be then that one who is omnipresent does not know what you are doing? What one has to be sure about, whether one is sincere. Because there are people who take up an attitude without reality. There are many people who follow conventionally. And when they do something, there is no corresponding movement of the consciousness. They do it conventionally, mechanically, or with only a dry idea in the mind. If it becomes living, it is immediately, there is a contact. Because the thing to which you refer is omnipresent. It is not as if you are to call somebody who is not present and an absentee landlord who, as I told you, left the management of the world in the hands of powers of ignorance forever. And he has simply said that this is an unmanageable job, I may better retire. No, it is not that. So it requires that fundamental faith that the divine is there. And that when you offer sincerely with the intense, aspiration and faith that the divine is there. Well, when you offer with sincerity, whatever action, Gita goes to the extent of saying that even if you offer me a leaf and a petal of a flower, well, that is the real offering. Gita, in the one of the verses, says that even if a petal of flower is offered to me, well, I accept it. So the consciousness on the other side is quite active in the sense of capacity of being receiving the offering. Well, what one has to do is to make the offering. A sincere giving up of action to the divine is a sacrifice. Then it has a revert, a return. And in the return, Gita advises and gives the next step, that the next step must be to give up the sense of oneself being the actor. because the powers which are given to man for action are not his own personal property, but are given to him. The energies with which we act, the willpower, the physical power, the mental power, you know, consciousness power, organizing power, whatever power one has, is given to him, really speaking. It is not, you know, something got up from nowhere, from absolutely within oneself. It has been acquired. It has been given by parentage, by society, by religion, by culture, by books, by friends, by school, by teachers, by friends, by all kinds of, you know, energies. So that the feeling that one is this ego or this personality or this idea or this desire is a partial truth. It is not right. In fact, it is one of the actions of nature by which nature keeps hold on man and keeps him ignorant. It prevents true knowledge. The feeling that one is only the body, or one is only the idea, one is only so and so, or one is only a mixture of all these things put together, that is itself thing that continues the bondage of ignorance of man. The first thing he has to recover that he is not this. That man, what you call I, is not the body, or is not the bundle of desires or impulses or emotions or thoughts. That there is a true I, and that true I is not the body. So the idea that one is acting under guidance, or under the impulse of desire or impulse, that he is responsible, is falsehood. So the next step is that he begins to understand and realize that he is not the actor. That universal energy in him is acting through his mind, through his will, cosmic energy, divine energy, or energy that is absolutely impersonal to him. It is not his personal property in the sense that he can handle it when he likes. In fact, if you study history of great persons, you will see that at a certain time they went on, and whatever they did was absolutely successful. After that time, you find suddenly there is such a drop, and you wonder, what happened to that man? What happened? Well, that energy has receded, that's all. The cosmic universal energy that was working in him, in his form, so to say, or had taken him up as the instrument, has abandoned him, that's all. Take any big career, especially, you know, a brilliant career like Napoleon. You see him when he's rising to power. Well, you find his most unimportant looking man, you know, it was called Little Corporal. That was his name. His name when he was studying in the military college was Little Corporal. He was small in size and most insignificant looking man in the military department. I mean, in military, they generally go in for big size, you know, height and breadth and all kinds of. He was a little corporal, so insignificant he looked. And he was nobody before 24. It is after 25 and 24 that he came to the front, began to come to the front. And still more prominent he became when he came in contact with Josephine. It was not Josephine, is it not? Yes, it was Josephine. I forget whether I am right in the name, that's all. You see? And you see, the rise means it is from corporeal to command, and command to general, and general to leader of France, dictator of Europe. And after 1814, you see, what happened to that Napoleon? Absolutely, something, you see, it's gone out. I'm only trying to illustrate that there are instances of individual and collective, you know, groups of men in which the energy has utilized those either individuals or groups as instruments. And when the instrument is done, well, the same man is not able to do anything. Very same. And in India, there is a very, you see, they have very subtle mind that way. So in Indian mythology, illustration is given of Arjuna himself, this Arjuna, who is in the Gita. That after the battle of Kurukshetra, when he had won the battle, he went to pay a visit to Dwarka where Krishna was living. And after living with Krishna, he was coming back from Dwarka to go to Delhi, this capital. And in the middle, he had to pass through a mountain, you know, say region, mountainous region. And there he was waylaid by the aboriginals, like the Red Indians, you see. And Arjun, with the same bow with which he had fought the battle and won the battle of Kurukshetra, defeated the greatest warriors of the times, He could not resist them. And those people looted him, insulted him, took away all the property, and Arjuna was really downcast. And then he tried to inquire, and then Sri Krishna appeared to him and told him, "You think that you were doing everything, now you realize what you can do? You think that you were doing everything, now you realize what you can do, how far you can do alone. It is that which was working." You see? Well, this is only to illustrate the necessity of feeling that the sense of one's being the doer is a cheat. He is really the cheat of the human individual, perpetuating his round of ignorance in, you know, desires and ideas and thoughts and so on, responsibility and I, and all the time it is I, and it is troublesome business, you see. You can't get out of the circle. The most important part is to realize there is a real I. And that real I is not this. That real I is cosmic. That real I is divine. And you begin to realize that real I by separating yourself from your own nature and feeling that, oh, there is something in us, in every human being, something that can look at the thought most impersonally, as if the thoughts, ideas, impulses, you know, suggestions that were coming were not his own. Well, that is that I, beginning of the true I. It is not ego, it is absolutely impersonal. It is not connected with sin or virtue or goodness or badness or whatever happens. A rascal can do this and feel that the I in him is divine. Even the most dishonest man can see his dishonesty and see, oh, this fool is a dishonest man. That's all. And he will not feel affected by what is his nature. That is the first ground of freedom. Gita says that when he has given up the sense of I being the doer, then he gets into the practice gradually that energy that is his is not personal but universal. And who is acting through this energy? The one that really is the I. And that I is in everybody, the same I. The same universal I is working everywhere in one particular station, in one particular position. That I takes up one nature, one constitution, one structure of nature and uses it. Well, at another point, the same I takes up another nature, uses it. Well, this is used for a big purpose, this is used for a small purpose. It is nothing to, it is one purpose that is being worked, you see. That is how one has to understand this detachment as a necessary part of karma yoga, in which when one has got out of the feeling that I am the doer, then he finds out that there is an I that can be completely detached in mind from all thoughts, from train of thought. One can separate and watch the train of thought as if it was not his own in the personal sense, but was only passing through his mind. Well, that ground of freedom one has to secure, because that becomes ultimately the ground from which he can command his nature. And when he has given up his action to the divine all the time, and also realize that the powers that are working in him are not his own, then really cosmic powers begin to work in him. The cosmic intention, cosmic will, the cosmic, you know, the consciousness begins to operate in him. Then he finds that he is only a channel. And that the will that is even behind the cosmic will is the divine will. So one lives in that consciousness of the divine working in him and giving him the energy that is necessary for carrying out some will of the divine in him, realizing the will in him. That is the ladder of karma yoga. And when one has identified himself with the supreme will, then he comes down with that will to embody that will in life, so that the divine will, divine illumination or light of divine may come into, well, into the field of life, into the earth consciousness. His purpose is not to do any work. You understand? Work is only the excuse. Work is only a, you know, like a tap to open something. It may be, that is why in Gita it is very categorically pointed out that works, the outer form of work is not at all important. What flows through our work is consciousness. And if you can stop the lower consciousness for acting and allow the higher consciousness to flow, your work may be like that. It is not that. What flows through it is important, you see. And these people hardly realize. People think that unless work is very big, how can divine be there? In fact, as I very often pointed out to you, the bigger the work, very often bigger is the ego. Bigger is the attachment, bigger is the ambition of the man. Size is not the criterion of goodness or greatness of work. Sincerity and the origin from where it origins, that is the real criterion of finding out whether the work is spiritually great or spiritually justifiable veridic, you see, true. Spiritually true action is started from the true center of being, the divine center. And there, therefore, the each nature is used by this one divine consciousness or divine energy and will, well, for one purpose. Another center is used for another purpose. Third is for third purpose. And when one has identified himself in will, harmonized his will with the supreme will, known that he is not the actor, but the cosmic consciousness is the actor, and the cosmic consciousness is carrying out the will of the divine, well, one knows then the divine will that is working in the cosmos and working in him. In the cosmos, it may be working for far greater purpose. In him, it might be working for what people call a small purpose. But he knows that that is the cosmic purpose. There is no small cosmic purpose and big cosmic purpose. There is one cosmic purpose. And he allows that consciousness to flow into him. He is not concerned with whether the work succeeds in the outer sense of the term or not, or whether the work is approved by people or not, whether the work is appreciated or not, or whether the work is big or not. It is not the problem. Problem is whether the work brings down that light and the will in life. It may be in a small room and it may be absolutely unknown to anybody. It's not necessary that anybody know about your connection or sadhak's connection with the supreme consciousness. It is between one and the divine. There is no third individual necessary between, you see. The connection is with the individual and the divine. That's all, and it can be absolutely unknown to the outside world. And yet the effect would not be less, effective work. Work would be not less effective because people don't know. It is not by people's knowing that the work is done. Now this important aspect of life, which Gita points out, is the great contribution to man's progress, because man cannot give up action, cannot give up food, cannot give up working, and yet if he has real aspiration for spiritual life, well, he must have a chance, and it is only Gita that gives the chance, and a real chance in the sense that it can allow, it allows the man to convert his action, his field of action, into a means for rise. And then, not only means for rise, but a ladder for bringing down the light into life, which is still more greater contribution to world. Not only one rises, but one brings down, and brings down the light of the divine in life. Greater than that, there is no service that a man could render. It is to make this earth capable of any field of life fit for expression of the divine. Well, there is no greater, that work is by its very existence serves mankind, you see, because it brings qualities and powers which are nowhere to be found easily. First, it is charged with that peace. It is always self-poise and peace. It is not disturbed all the time. I have to do. There is no running about. There is no that sort of, disturbance of the being and, restlessness. There is a quiet poise. There is a steady attitude towards life. Whatever comes, there is no shaking in that. That Gita gives a very fine image. It says, Yathadipo nivatastho ningate, just as a lamp in windless room or place does not flicker. Lamp in a windless place, the flame of the lamp in a windless place does not flicker. Well, that is a steady attitude and a steady will. So it brings that peace and that detachment and that supreme will in life and creates an atmosphere not only within but outside, which is the need of mankind. It is exactly that is lacking in life. That's why people run from life. And I think Kumar Swami pointed out very well in one of his wonderful essays that people now want to leave their work to find joy because they cannot find joy in their work. It's true. They have to, because now inner joy and work have been isolated. Work is labor. Work is not joy. It is only when you do work as karma yoga that you find that work belongs not to you. You are free all the time. You may be doing hard work, but you are free. Free in the sense that there is no tension. Something is getting done and you are giving it over to somebody and you are free. You are weightless. You see, you are not weighed down by pressure of the environment or pressure of the circumstances or things around. You know that, it is given over now, let the divine do what it likes. And something comes, you are untouched because Gita proves that either in victory or defeat or in success or failure, in all circumstances, you must be detached and equal-minded. So you, as soon as it comes, you say, what is to be practiced? You don't say whether I shall run. First, as soon as something comes, first thing you ask, what is to be practiced from this? Therefore I must maintain my attitude of detachment. Yes, that's the first thing. Afterwards you attend to what is to be done. That's how karma yoga can be done. It cannot be done by, submitting to normal movements and sitting half an hour or 1 hour. No? Karma yoga is to be done all the time. You have to take up an attitude all the time. But it is eminently practical and it will bear results. That I can say. It will certainly give results. Only one has to get out of the old groove. You see, a man is doing something of karma on karma, base of karma yoga, and suddenly something comes which at once is like a, stone that disturbs the peace of the land, of the pond or the lake. But the first thing he has to do is how to get back to the peace. Not what to attend. No. The first thing is to attend inside. This is how karma yogi reconstitutes his nature. Karma yogi is a practice. It's not doing karma only. It is being conscious about the karma. It is knowing what one is doing and why one is doing. What is it that is propelling to action? And looking at the root and taking out if it is not the right root. Means if it is egoistic or desire or impulse, rejecting it. And whatever one decides on the highest point, offering it to the divine. In one sense, the formula is very simple. Question is whether one is sincere. That's all. The problem is whether one wants. It is not whether it can be done. It looks, when you look at it from that point of view, it looks very simple. Looks everybody could do it if he wanted to. The simple thing is to find out what is it that is moving one to action for every action. And then if he finds it is desire or impulse or egoism, reject it. What to do? Decide from the highest point, some ideal, some principle, some moral principle, some religious idea. Stand on that and decide. Offer that to the divine. And then get out after some long practice of 6 months, 1 year or 2 years into the feeling that you are not the doer. That will take time. But once you get out of it, you are in safe ground, because then you are in a wider field of cosmic consciousness, wider consciousness, and you know that the witness, the Purusha, the detached being that is in you is cosmic. And that in you stands the representative of the cosmos and the divine. So you take all the help from him, and with detachment you go on detaching more and more till you become wide like cosmos. And then the will of the divine, will of the cosmos reveals itself to you. Because you offer as a sacrifice, as a return, naturally the cosmic will has to inform you as to what it is, what it demands of you. Because your constitution is particular, nature is particularly constituted, capable of giving a certain work. So to each one, the task that is given is what is intended by the cosmic will. The intention automatically comes. You are not to create the intention. You see, it is like a factory in which the switches were ready. Now the switch is attached somewhere else, and so there is a machine, this kar, it's all the time breaking up, and all the time making disturbance. Well, when it is rightly switched That's all. There's nothing. It's ready. What is the cosmic will? One says, oh, I am to find. Here you can't find out. Detach from where it is and put it on the switch immediately. It is there. It's working. And you say, yes, it is all right. That's what it wants. All right. It will do it. Oh, this is to be done. That's to be done. It's all right. Oh, it doesn't succeed. Oh, it's not my business if it doesn't succeed. Oh, it has succeeded. The credit is not mine because it's somebody else who has done it, is it not? So that way you get into the line or harmony with the cosmic will. When really one has sincerely rejected the individual egoistic motive and ego from the center of his consciousness, he automatically will come in contact with the cosmic will, and the cosmic will work in him. Cosmic will not necessarily make a miracle, because cosmos is not a miracle, though it is a standing miracle and people don't see it because it is constant. If a miracle is constant, you don't notice a miracle. That is what Carlyle wrote in one of his books, you see. Custom is a great enchantress. Custom is a great enchantress. When you get accustomed to something, well, you lose all the greatness and grandeur about it afterwards. You never know that a sunrise is the most marvelous miracle that could happen in the whole universe. Nobody notices it because it happens every day. There is no greater miracle than sunrise every day, and that the same grass or the flower should give you the same flower every time it is put in the ground. It's a standing miracle, the whole universe, from smallest to the biggest, but nobody will notice it because it's constant daily, and you are accustomed, practice so. That's why who said that a hero is not a hero to his valet, is it not? So that's it. It is because of, he doesn't see the dimensions. He only sees that he's eating, he's drinking, he's going, he's sleeping, he's tired, he's this, he's that. But the inner he doesn't see. So well, the same thing happens, that cosmic will not be something extraordinary miraculous. What accompanies it will be the most miraculous thing, the peace and the quiet and the equanimity and the unselfishness or the egolessness. That will be extraordinary if you can notice it. That is something new. New in oneself and new to the world around, you see. And it is that which has to work. That's something. Then where are we? What was the point? Oh, I was talking about the sacrifice. You know, sacrifice, Gita speaks of sacrifice. And this ceremony or the ritual of sacrifice is as old as the Veda. And in the Veda, the sacrifice is charged with double sense, an external sense and an inner sense. It is physical and psychological, you see. There was at that time a society which was given to outer ritual. Society was not so advanced as the rishis were advanced. Rishis were a minority, leaders of spiritual and social life, and the majority was given to outer, ceremonials. And they devised this sacrifice as the central, ceremonial, because to them it appeared as a very fine sacrifice of an inner movement. So they gave, this currency to this outer material sacrifice as a symbol of an inner sacrifice. But in time, its ceremony alone remained and the inner sacrifice completely disappeared, till Gautam Buddha had to raise his voice against it and say that by sacrifice you can't attain anything, by mere outer sacrifice. And in fact, I gave you the joke that somebody said that when you put an animal into this fire, well, you are not cruel or killing. No, the priest said, the animal goes to heaven. So he said, then why don't you just put your father into it? Because then he might go to heaven. You see, straight away. So you see, that was the condition to which it was reduced. Well, but sacrifice was always a symbol, is proved by second thing, that Upanishad also, which came least 1200 to 1500 years after the Veda, the Upanishads speak of the world as a sacrifice, the cosmos as a sacrifice, and they speak of it as Ashwamedha, the horse sacrifice. The universe is a horse sacrifice. Horse is symbol of energy. That is a Vedic symbol. You see, horse and cow. Cow is a symbol of light, horse is a symbol of energy. So he says, this universe is a horse sacrifice, the energy sacrifice. And dawn is the head of the horse. That is Brahadaranyaka Upanishad, beginning first verse of Brahadaranyaka. You see, it says, dawn is the head of the, you know, the horse sacrificial. Yes, that's it. Dawn is the head of the horse sacrificial. Kal, time. Dawn is the time, you see, movement. The sun is the eye of the horse. Remember, now we are dealing with a horse. The whole cosmos is a horse. It's a tremendous image, you know. It is bizarre, but it is living. It's terrific. It is more than poetic. It is sublime. The whole cosmos is a horse. And dawn is the head. Sun is the eye of that horse. And oceans and mountains and so on, so on, so on, so on. And then it says, ear is his soul. Ear is the soul of this horse. Time, measure of time, that is the soul. Well, it is the divine movement of time, you know, time eternity flowing from timeless eternity of the divine. But that is sacrifice. I'm bringing out this point of sacrifice, that this cosmos is a sacrifice. And Upanishad speaks also as several kinds of sacrifices. One sacrifice is, the sun is burning. Oh, yes. It is a sacrificial fire that is at work, and the smoke of that fire is the rays of the sun that are coming. I'm giving the text of the Upanishads, you see. The sun is the Vedi, is the altar in which the fire is burning, and the smoke of the sacrifice is the rays that are coming. So you see, there you see that sacrifice is regarded as a symbol, not regarded as a material ceremony or outer, you know, ritual. Gita here speaks of this sacrifice now. This sacrifice has already become symbolic, and Gita speaks of 8 or 10 kinds of sacrifice here. So clearly showing that sacrifice was not only the ceremonial, but even up to Gita time, the sacrifice was rendered in 7 or 8, you know, figures or 7 or 8 symbols. Now here, the symbol is, sacrifice is, in the heart of the human being, there is altar. The heart is the altar. And the flame of aspiration for the divine is the fire. Fire is not that which you light here in the outer material altar, but fire is the fire of aspiration for the divine in the heart of man. That is the Agni. That is the fire. And one has to keep the fire burning, have the flame of aspiration awake in the heart. The definition of Arya, one who was an Aryan, was that one in whose house the fire is burning is Arya, and one in whose house the fire is not burning is non-Aryan. It was not some tribe, you know, an aboriginal tribe, but it was somebody in whose heart the flame of aspiration was not awake, was not entitled to higher knowledge. And one in whose heart the flame was awake was the Aryan, was the man who had a qualification for higher life. Well, this Gita here speaks of the sacrifice. And these sacrifices were regarded, this interpretation of sacrifice is Gita's one original contribution to the further symbolism of the way, of the yajna, of the sacrifice. All life is sacrifice. Only it is an ignorant sacrifice performed by powers of nature, and men be compelled to sacrifice. You see, in life you can never find a man who is not compelled to sacrifice. He will have to. Nature will compel him to, because that's the law of life. Gita puts it like that very positively in one chapter. You see that the creator, when he created the world, sahayagna praja srishtva puruvacha prajapati, the creator of the world created the worlds and peoples, and with the people he created sacrifice and said, look, take this sacrifice with you, only by that you will be able to increase. You see, you take this sacrifice with you and by this sacrifice you will increase. And that is the law of interchange. You cannot live without interchange. You must give and take. You cannot constantly go on taking. You will be compelled to give. That's all. The universal sacrifice is sacrifice of compulsion by nature. Under ignorance, pressure, one is compelled to give. By attachment, he is compelled to work for his children or work for society or for his relation, for his friends. He works compulsorily under ignorance. When one is awakened, he does the sacrifice with knowledge. He knows that that is the law and that the divine powers are at work and cosmic will is demanding the sacrifice. So he sacrifices to the divine will straight away. There, Gita points out that the two kinds of sacrifice, one is the compelled sacrifice of nature and the awakened sacrifice of the karma yogin, I mean the man who knows what he is doing and sacrificing to the universal consciousness. And one point in which you will see here from the essays on the Gita, on sacrifice, there is a passage which I just cite for you to know in original how Sri Aurobindo explains this point. There was a double sense, physical and psychological, outward and symbolic. But the secret of symbol of yagna or sacrifice of the ancient Vedic mystics, which was exact, curious, poetic and psychological, had been long forgotten by this time, and it is now replaced by another large, general and philosophical symbol in the spirit of the Vedanta and later Yoga, Karma Yoga. The Gita is restoring the sense of yagna now with a philosophical sense, not psychological. But it is symbol all the same. The fire of sacrifice, Agni, is no material flame, but the Brahma Agni, the fire of the infinite divine, the fire of the sacrifice into which the offering is poured. The fire is also, according to Gita, fire of self-control. You see, Gita says, japa yagna, tapa yagna, dana yagna, gnana yagna, brahma yagna. You see, evam bahuvidha yagna vituta brahmano mukhe. Like this, many kinds of sacrifices are stretched or given over to into the altar of the Brahman. The Supreme Infinite Consciousness receives various types of sacrifices. Japa, tapa, remembrance, you see, jnana, dana, even charity, all are sacrifices offered into the mouth of the Infinite Consciousness, the Brahman. Yes. So he is translating it in English now. The fire is a self-control or purified sense action, or it is a vital energy in the discipline of control by the vital being through the control of breath, which is a common Raja Yoga and Hatha Yogic practices. Or it is a fire of self-knowledge, the flame of supreme sacrifice, Jnana Yagna, the knowledge of sacrifice of knowledge. The sacrifice is that in which, here Gita declares that the act, the energy and the material of sacrifice, the giver, the receiver of the sacrifice, the goal and the object of the sacrifice are all the one Brahman, the infinite divine consciousness. Brahma arpanam, Brahma havid, Brahma agno, Brahma nahutav, Brahma ivatena gantavyam, Brahma karma samadhina. That's the text, you see. Now, that is the text in the context which he is giving translation. This is the translation, he says. The Brahman is the giving. Brahman is the food offering. What is offered is the Brahman. Brahman is offered into the Brahman fire. Brahman is that which is to be attained by this concentration in the action of the Brahman or action for the Brahman. The flame, the will that is at work is an aspect of the infinite. The material which you take and throw into the sacrifice is also an objective aspect of the sacrifice of the Supreme Infinite. You see, the intention which you have also representative only of the same Infinite. So Gita is therefore showing that it is the one omnipresent reality which is at work. And if one is conscious of that, all his action will be directed towards an offering to that all-pervading cosmic being, cosmic energy and cosmic power at work. Yes. This then is the knowledge in which the liberated man has to do his works of sacrifice. It is the knowledge declared of old in the Vedantic formulas of I am He, that omnipresent reality, infinite being. It is that which is in all this verily is the Brahman, Sarvam Khalu Idam Brahma. All this indeed is the Brahman. And also it is, the Brahman is the Self, I am Atma Brahma. This soul that one has of the Self is the Brahman. So the doer is the Brahman, the material which he uses is an aspect or one particular, you know, manifestation of the Brahman. The fire into which he is thrown is also an aspect of energy of the Brahman. And the object is to reach the infinite. So that it is the one omnipresent reality that is at work, and is the realization of that which the sacrifice leads to. It is the knowledge of the entire unity. It is the one divine manifest as the doer, manifest as the deed, and manifest as the object of work. He is the knower, he is the knowledge, and the object of knowledge. You see, gives you some idea of the sacrifice which Gita speaks. Well, that symbolism being finished, now we take up one point. And what is the objective of the yoga of the Gita, karma yoga, I mean? To live in God and not in the ego, first. To move not in the ego, but in the vast cosmic or transcendent consciousness. To choose the action, not by personal need, but by the truth within oneself. Whatever the plane of truth or aspect of truth that to which one has reason. You do not have the highest truth to begin with, but it must be decided by, not by personal need or any other pressure, but by the truth. Truth that is within oneself. By divine will carry and by divine will to carry it out with the help of the divine Shakti. Second point in Karma Yogi practice is to be perfectly equal to all happenings. Whatever happens, to remain unmoved, detached, and summer, equanimous, equanimity it is. It is not indifference, but equanimity. To be perfectly equal means equanimous to all happenings and to all beings. One with one's own self, one with the divine within oneself, all in oneself because all in God, and God in all and oneself in all. That will be the realization or concrete experience of the practice of Karma Yoga. Something about equality can be said. I referred partly to it once when we were talking, I suppose, if I remember right. But I'm not sure whether I fully developed the subject of equality, because it's a very big subject. By itself, it can take a week. This equality, you see, it's samatha, equality or equanimity of temperament. But here, you can say that it can be easily, it has four statuses or four methods of working, this equality, according to the nature of the man. If the nature of man is strong, resolute, like the Stoic, you see, he can arrive at what might be called a Stoic equality. Equanimity of a Stoic. Stoic is one who has got the power of endurance, you see. You put your will and give an equal return to all contacts, all impacts, all shocks. Decided that you will not be moved by pleasant or unpleasant. But you stand there receiving all the shocks. This is called in Sanskrit titiksha. It is power of bearing or endurance, you see. roughly, if you go to the physical, you can say heat and cold. Now, the man who has got this, you know, endurance power or titiksha, he does not avoid the contact, he feels and, well, refuses to react to one in favor of the other. No, he resists both them with equal, you know, power of endurance. If it is hot, well, it is received the same vibration as when it is very cold. It is on the nervous plane. Well, the same thing you take into the inner, vital, mental, emotional, or plane of any plane of consciousness. That whatever impact comes and strikes the being, well, it is received by power to endure and to put the will immediately and throw out any impact that wants to disturb, you see. Because the general result of outer impact is to disturb the equilibrium or disturb the existent equanimity or peace or poise of the being. That is what generally takes place. So one reacts to it by the power of endurance with a strong will generally, and bears all impacts or contacts without being moved by a power of rejecting the effect. Bears all impacts or contacts without being moved by a power of rejecting the effect. There is another, and which is more, you know, more akin to a temperament which is detached and intellectual or mental. You see, he likes to separate himself and sit on a high seat. You see, the plane of disturbance is normal consciousness, normal nature. Vital being, nervous being, you know, being full of desires and impulses and, well, normal nature of man. Well, he sits above, and from a seat on the top, he watches the reaction of his own being, but as if he was watching somebody else's reaction. This is a Purusha consciousness, but Purusha with the power of detachment. It is called Udasina in Sanskrit. Udasina, sitting above. Here the other man was not sitting above, but facing the contact, is it not? Facing the shock. Here he is sitting above. It's like one, supposing two armies are fighting or two people are fighting. And if somebody is sitting on the hill, he is able to see the two people fighting more clearly even than they sometimes. You see, when he is on the hill, he is able to observe the maneuvers and the possibilities far better than the people engaged in the battle. Because he sees from a high seat, first of all, and he is not in the melee, he is not in the turmoil. And because he is sitting above, he sees clearly. And that is very often the people in the field of action, you know, commit a mistake in thinking that if a man is not acting, he cannot know what is good for action. In fact, sometimes exactly because he doesn't act, he knows better what is correct action. A politician, you see, when he is running in this circle, he doesn't know what he is doing. From a detached point of view, he knows what he is doing, but what mistake he is coming, he is not able to see. It is only somebody sitting somewhere else that sees that this is committing mistake. Now he is going. You see, if one car was coming from a passage and another car was coming, and you know there is only one road and it's going to have a collision, you see, is going to have a crash. Well, the man who is dying says, I know. Yes, of course he knows. And how can somebody, what somebody can know better than he knows? And if he has communication and means, he can prevent him from going and dashing himself, isn't it? He can say, please stop, don't go. Or go slow. But people in action have this illusion. And because they are acting mostly from egoistic point of view, and they always think that one who is not doing work like them, oh, he is idle, he is this, he is, that's what they charge against the greatest spiritual personalities. They always say like that, oh, what is he doing? He is simply sitting there. Of course he is sitting there and knowing better for you. He knows better what you should do, but you don't want to ask him. He is not bothered about telling you, but he knows certainly better for you what you should do. That's an advantage of not doing action in the normal way. And doing action from the from the divine point of view, then you know better what is correct action. Well, that is Udasin, the one sitting above in his own nature, is able to see the disturbance in himself better and set it right and say, that is old habit. You see, an old impression being revived, supposing one is disturbed, an old impression revived. When he's sitting quiet, he said, that's for old. He's still like that. He doesn't want to change. He will go on like that, like a fool. Well, and the moment the disturbance is not able to affect you at all, you say, that is when I was 16 or 17, I have been doing like an idiot and I have not yet changed. Look at that. And you can be quite nice about it. And it doesn't affect you at all. In fact, the disturbance is not able to come and shake the center. That is important. Well, it will go out, die down, because it doesn't get any hold, you see. It catches and increases if you allow it to have a hold. The second point in which you do is Udasin, therefore sitting above the disturbance. One is receiving with power of endurance. The third is receiving with resignation, you see. Resignation to the divine will. You say that, well, what has happened was perhaps necessary because God thought so. Something has happened, nothing happens without God's consent, so perhaps this what has come is coming from the divine. So you take it with the resignation. So according to devotional temperament or willpower or intellect, one will acquire a type of equality or equanimity which is, you know, of the endurance type or the sitting above or accepting with resignation, you see, with resignation to the divine will working in life, working in the world. But Gita refers really to a still higher status, really speaking. When Gita refers to equality, Gita refers to a still higher status in which one will rise to a point where he is equal because he perceives the one in all. That equality is founded on the infinite. See? That is founded, that is a sign of one's direct or indirect contact with the infinite. That when all contacts are received as contacts of the one, a supreme, infinite, omnipresent reality at work. And whatever comes is a result of, well, the operation of that cosmic, omnipresent reality. And then the equality that is founded on the perception of the one in all, one in oneself and one in all, that is perfect equality, because that is the power of the divine, that is power of the infinite itself. In fact, Sri Aurobindo says in the essays that it is by that equality that the Brahman maintains this world. It is by that equal support extended to all. It is called Samam Brahma, the infinite which is equal to all, good, bad and indifferent, sinner and the saint and everybody. Well, it is that which is present in all. Well, then the equality is founded in the right foundation or right reality. That's about all. There is a very little left of the Gita, except perhaps half an hour tomorrow or day after. I don't know when.
Equality I say that the one and all doesn't have anything to do with the what Sri Aurobindo calls the relationship with the living. With the two and one, Purusha Prakriti or Ishwara Ishwari. He says that everything in this world is just a relationship between two, like you might put it as between Krishna or Radha.
Yes. That is duality. That is when you explain or when you enter into the process of creation. Here we are trying to understand the results of Karma Yoga and the conditions that follow the practice of Karma Yoga. In that, this realization of equality is a realization of complete equal support extended by the Supreme to everything. It is in that experience that you get in at the height. You can begin with endurance. You can begin with indifference or detachment and sitting above. You can begin with resignation. Or you can begin with all the three, if you are capable. But ultimately, it will lead you to a concrete realization of the presence of one in all. Then you will be really founded on equality, the same equality with which the infinite supports all movements of cosmos without partiality. The support that is extended to the sinner is not less than the support that is extended to the saint. Do you understand? Yes, that equal support is that which is the real basis of equality.
You don't get any sense of difference?
Hmm?
You don't get any sense of difference in that equality?
No.
No. Variation?
Yes, that equality is not unconsciousness. Equality is not being moved. A man who is in equality knows, he understands, he knows what is happening and how it is happening, but he is not moved, that's all. It is not as if he is unconscious or he doesn't care. No, it is not, as a disappointed resignation. Is it not the word that I gave you? Yes. It is not disappointed resignation or carelessness about anything happening. No, that is not. The intention is there, the purpose is there, the divine will is known, this must happen. And if it doesn't happen, he is not affected.
I was thinking of the perception of the one. It doesn't come all at once, right? Does it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you perception of the one and all,
yes,
you know,
and
all in one,
yes,
that wouldn't
yes.
come immediately, would
that? Not at all. That's why I said the steps, you see, that you can resort if you have a strong willpower to endurance. If you have a strong intellect, you can practice sitting above all disturbances. Or if you are devotional minded, you can practice resignation and arrive at samatha, equality. And when you arrive at equality, it will lead you to this experience, you see. When you establish equality in parts of nature by the dominance of one part, which you use for establishing equality in nature, then gradually it will widen out into this concrete experience. Have a mental practice of the presence of the one, but it is only a mental practice, it's not realization. There are people who practice and do something with it and make a little progress also. A mental practice of the presence of the one in all. It may prepare one for the experience also, you see. A mental practice is possible and it's not bad. Only one should not mistake it for experience. People, when they practice with the mind, all the time remembering that it is the one with whom we are dealing. It is the one that I am coming in contact. It is the one that is here. It is the one that is here. It is that one whom I am like that. Well, it's a good practice, but it's a mental effort and a mental realization. It is not realization, you see. It is, one can say, effort at realizing a truth, but it's not realization of the truth. Is it? But better would be the other practice, I think, which is more touches the whole core of yoga, you see. A mental practice might be completely isolated from life, whereas here establishment of equality from mind or emotional being or vital being would be a very practical thing which would deal with your nature, you see, and will insist on a change in nature, which is more important than a mental, repetition or mental realization or construction of the mind, which you try to put upon your mind so as to remind you of the truth. That's all that it can do. It hardly would lead you to concreteness of the experience, you see. And especially if you are satisfied with the mental idea, well, it might even block the way to further experience. Best would be to allow the experience to develop by itself.
This is a very, very different type of karma.
Yes.
Why is it called karma?
Karma is action, work.
Yogi of work.
Yoga of works, yes. Yoga of action, yoga of work. Not of meditation. Meditation in work, through work.
Yes, but it embodies the finest type, a very fine type of meditation.
Yes, it is wonderful. That's why Gita is unique in the world scripture. No scripture has given this detail and this philosophy. Nobody. That I can say. Because great people also have said the same thing. Not I only. Everybody who has read it has said, oh, nobody said like this, this way. Say step by step by step by step, he puts on. And clearly he says action and work and this and why work and so on. So it's a unique way of putting. And it's very effective for modern man. It is very apt for this mind that is working today in humanity. If it wants to practice yoga, if it doesn't want, Gita is not. Gita is quite content to remain where she is. It is very applicable to life today. If one has any intention and real inclination for spiritual life, well, he can get any amount of guidance from it.
Swami, would you mind repeating once more for me? I didn't get all of the sitting above, witness, endurance, yes, being equal.
Yes.
And then there were two more.
Resignation. Resignation, accepting things that come as a resignation to the divine's will, accepting as the will of the Lord, you see. And then after that, when this establishment of equality has been successful, then it will develop into the equal side, the presence of the one in all. And that equality will be true foundation, because that is the equality of the Brahman, the infinite. It is the equal support with the supreme, you know, extends to everything, irrespective of what it is. It is that into which the sadhak enters when he enters that vision of the one. And the quality and power of the Brahman, you see, it's the power of the infinite, this equality. It is not man's acquired thing at all. It is something that comes to him from the supreme. And he knows that it is solid than this, more solid than this.
Also, I'm afraid I didn't take in, are these four steps that one passes through, or could one arrive through any one of them?
Yes, anyone. Any one of them, any two of them, any three of them. But the culmination will be the experience of the one in all. In all events and in all persons. That's equal mindedness to all events and all persons. All beings, in fact.
Is that what is commonly referred to as cosmic consciousness?
No. It is more than cosmic in one sense. It's a result of the operation of infinite consciousness. It's a result of the operation of infinite consciousness in organized human being. In the human being, the experience will come as an equality. And it's the power of the Supreme, the power of the infinite consciousness.
Oh,
you know,
and
when
one thinks
of
St. Paul and his epistle to the Romans,
yes,
you come across magnificent passages.
I'm sure you do.
Similar.
Yes, I'm sure you do.
What shall separate us from the love of God? Shall fire and famine and the sword and peril and nakedness and so on?
Yes.
All of these he suffered.
Yes.
He said, through these very things we are more than conquerors, you see. And he said, I can't get the scripture because I memorized it, but I hadn't read it for some time.
Well, it's not important, memory or not. It's a practice that is important. It is to carry it out into effect, you see, into life. I don't know how many Christians have carried out or understood it, but that is for them to do. Here is something very tangible, practical, and doesn't require any authority. It may be Saint Paul or anybody. Gita doesn't say, accept me. Gita says, here is a logic that I give you. It's a logic and a process given rationally. That's all. So it doesn't require Saint Paul, then a Mohammedan will come and say, I don't believe in Saint Paul. Or a Hindu will say, oh my dear, Veda is as good as Saint Paul. You see? Well, Gita says, no, you want to realize some truth, you believe in some truth, all right? You want to realize it? Yes. You want to do it by action? Well, here is a process. You see, it is universal. It is international. It is open to anybody. He doesn't say, believe in my authority before I argue, say, accept me. No, it says, do you want? Well, this is the process. Does it appeal to you? Take it. Leave it otherwise. It's very clear and very cogent and rational and very international, open to everybody. And that is its great strength. Upanishad also the same thing. We don't know the author even. Here you remember the name of St. Paul. Who wrote the Upanishad? Nobody knows. And yet people have preserved it for 5,000 years, simply because it contains some truth and says, oh, you want to be quiet? You want to attain peace? All right, this is the process. Take it. Nobody took it. All right, it remained in the books. And some people practice it and said, this is good. So they remembered all those things. But there were people who practiced it. So what is required is practice to make it living, you see. There are great truths in every scripture, because every age has brought down the divine light. And it's the same light that has every time to come in new form. Eternity does not consist in sameness or uniformity. Eternity is not unchangeableness. Eternity is constant power of self-renewal, eternal youth, eternal capacity to take infinite number of new forms, fresh life. That is a sign of eternity. And the same divine truth, when it comes at one age, after 1,000, 2,000 years, the same divine life comes in another form, because the age requires a fresh manifestation and a fresh formation of that eternal. Do you understand? And so we have to see what will fit in for our age. That's all. It's not refusal of any light. We have to take the light that will give us the same light for us, for today. The same light. Light is the same, but every day the morning is the same. It is not the same. Phenomenon of morning is the same. Is it not?
Yes.
Yes, that's right. And no two mornings are the same. No two flowers and no two birds sing and open on the same day. Is it not?
Yes.
Yes, right. Yes, yeah. No change. Look again. Again, then you will say eternal again, you will forget. Mm-hmm. It is eternal. And constant renewal and constant freshness. You follow? No two mornings are the same. No two birds in the morning sing the same note on the same tree. No two flowers flower on the same tree. Every day there is a fresh outburst of flower and freshness of life. That is eternity. Do you understand? If it continued the same, we call it inert. Tagore will call it achalayatana. Fixed habitation which is solidified into stone. If we say it can't change, it is not eternal. Constant renewal and constant rejuvenation and power of freshness. Ever fresh, ever fresh, ever new. That is eternal. And it is that eternal truth which is manifesting every age when humanity requires it, takes a form that meets the need of the age. That's all. There is no refusal of a light. Light is light. And yet when it comes here, we say, this is the light. That was the light. This is the light. And this is the light we want. That's all. We don't say anything else. Was light and is light, nobody refuses. In fact, in several declarations of Vivekananda, Ramakrishna, Sri Aurobindo, and so many Indian spiritual people, you will find the assertion of the incarnations of all the people accepted. All incarnations, because they are all divine. When the whole world is divine, how can they refuse divinity to great incarnations? You can understand. The stand of India is that the whole is a manifestation of an omnipresent reality. How can they refuse divinity to an incarnation? They all accept. But an applicability or necessity of the form or necessity of the time, conditions of the age, environment, development of man, his present problem, present situation, demands the formation of that eternal truth in terms of present applicability. And that when it is presented to us, Well, it is profitable for us to accept for our own advantage. It is not. If you don't accept, it doesn't matter. It's our choice. We can reject. Mankind does reject. It always does like that. And Mother wrote a message on this point only. She says it's the habit of humanity to put an incarnation of the past and pit it against incarnation of the present. That is always the tendency of human nature. You can't help it. And yet the incarnation is there. And then it is after 1,000 years that people recognize, oh yes, this was incarnation. Thing moves slow, there is nobody's fault. Nobody wants to be perverse or nobody wants to be unjust. But it's nature. We say Prakriti, it's nature. It can change, but it's slow to change. Especially if I allow it. Millions of people who believe like that they have nothing to learn. There are many millions. Oh, in Benares when I was there, I had a time of it. They said, ours is eternal religion. I said, which eternal religion? Bullock cart. See? Benares, I'm talking of my country, you see. Ours is the eternal religion. Which eternal religion? Bullock cart is your eternal religion, and now you are going for cars. And you know, the railways and macadamized roads, there you don't want to be eternal. Remain eternal if you can. You can't. You could not remain eternal. 200 years back, when the Rajputs or the Mughals were there was one eternal religion. 400 years back, when the Hindus were ruling, there was one eternal religion. 2,000 years back, when Gautam Buddha was there was another eternal religion. Which is your eternal religion? What I say? What are you talking? Which is eternal? Truth has come to you in a living form. It is living. Then best is to see whether it appeals to our life and applies to our life. All right, accept. Otherwise, there is no such eternal religion. I said, Ganges is flowing and people come to take bath in the Ganges by millions. And these Benares fellows require a waterworks. There were no waterworks before. Everyone was taking baths in the Ganges. They have waterworks now, you know. Benares city people have got waterworks. I said, why you require waterworks? Why change? Eternal, it must remain. Eternal, take baths. Why? Why don't you eternally take baths in the Ganges? As I said, Vedas throw them in the Ganges. They were up. My God, they were like that.
Buried up the storm.
Yes, I said, throw them in the Vedas. There is nothing in it. What is that? All words, words, words. It's a holy river. Throw them in the holy river, I said. Why? I said, what is the meaning of the Veda? Can you explain? 50 commentaries are written on this Veda, I said. 50 commentaries I know. Now, which is true? Who is going to rake his head over what 50 people are telling about something which nobody can be sure about? So better throw it in the Ganges. Is the Veda living in you? Are you able to live the Veda? Well, then I understand you mean something by the Veda. Otherwise, it's all right. The book is all right. To put it in the water, it is good. Read 50 commentaries. Who has time, energy, and understanding to go through and decide what is right, who is right, what the original man want, who nobody can know? What is this? Let truth be living. Then we know what it is. You see, if a man describes that, my grandfather saw the sun, it was wonderful. You don't know it was marvelous. I know, but then, well, if there is sunrise, we say, here is the sun. That's an end of the matter. You get it? There is a sun. I know now it is a sun. Finished. Even if you have a ray, if you have a light, one understands it's light. But if you go, if somebody describes that, you see, we had a wonderful sunrise. Oh yes, I know it was wonderful sunrise. I don't doubt it was wonderful. Only I want to see a wonderful sunrise now, here, today.
Well, as you know, I don't doubt anything was there.
No, I'm not saying you doubt. This is human nature. I'm not saying you or anybody. This is nature. Every There is a conception that you see, we have nothing to learn from anything, and we are possessed of the truth. This is Indian idea, and more people in India than I think anywhere else are obsessed with the idea that they have got eternal truths. And I know that they haven't got. And this conception is very difficult to give up. Millions, I tell you, not X, Y, or Z, not you or anybody. I'm talking, and this is a fact which happened in 1947, when I went to Benares for the first time when Dr. Maitra was living. I told them plainly because I don't want anything. I say what I believe, and I tell them my reasons why I believe. Finished. There is an end of the matter. They said, our religion is eternal, and Sanatan Dharma, they said, you see eternal. I said, what is this eternal religion? I don't understand.
We have the same thing here.
Everywhere. It's human nature. That's what I am telling you. It's not your defect. You see, it is human nature. That always, you see, it is the view is turned to the past and not to the present or future. What we want is to now here and try to see what we want to bring here. You see, all the time we're looking back. Well, that light has worked and created this present. The point is that light has created this present. All the gain is in us. All that the past has given is in the present. Past is not dead. Past is actually living in the present, you see. So whatever has been contributed by the whole world is now here with us. What we have to see, where we are going, to what direction, whether we are going consciously toward the light. That's all. We have got all the advantage of the past. We are standing on the past. We are not standing on zero or void. All that has been done is not lost to us. All that has been contributed is there, solid. And we take our stand on the solid progress of the past and try to see how we can carry the progress toward the future. The future cannot be taken back to the past. That is a difficulty with human nature. History cannot, we cannot go back. Cannot go back like that. It's not possible, even if you want to. We can bring back anything living to now. Yes, if there is anything living, then you make it live, then it will live in us. In some evening talks that you see about people like Anatole France and his Bernard Shaw and so on, they want to be clever at any cost. So some people whose mind is active, they always want to be engaged in, as I told you, you see, keep the mind busy with something. So that's good. There's nothing wrong. It's an innocent pastime, quite nice in its own way. One man has written a thesis on Sri Aurobindo and St. Paul. By the way, when you say St. Paul, it reminds me. Dr. Hackett, who is working in Louisiana University as professor of philosophy, he wrote a thesis on comparison of life divine and St. Paul.
Is that beautiful?
PhD thesis.
I'd like to see it.
I will see it in Syracuse, as I told you. He told me that he would have sent me, but his copy is not nice. But he said, please, when you go to New York, you go to Syracuse, and there are two copies there kept of my thesis. You take one and read it. I asked for it. I wrote to him to send me the thesis here, you see. When I came to know, sometime back at Albuquerque, a friend told me, professor friend, that he took his doctorate on Sri Aurobindo's philosophy. So I wrote to him a letter, please send me your thesis. So he says, his thesis is not in good condition, paper is not nice and torn, but there are two copies in the University of Syracuse, and I can get it because they circulate. So I'll get it.
That would be extremely
nice. Yes, very interesting.
Because St. Paul is a very dynamic person.
No, I have no doubt about that.
And he didn't carry writing to light.
Yes.
And he sacrificed himself. I mean, he literally went to Rome. And they say that even the soldiers that watched over him, he converted, and they sat down with him, and that everywhere he went.
Yeah, otherwise Christianity wouldn't have been into existence at all. The result, that's it. The result of all that was the organization of Christian life. That's all. It organized Christian religion. That is the merit, and that's the advantage, because humanity gained many things by that organization, and through the church, through the people, many people became pious, devoted, and good. Well, that is all that it has done, and good work it has done, very good solid work. Now it can go, I can tell you from a report which has appeared in books, that they go to visit the St. Paul's Cathedral as a museum. They actually have written, they go to it as a museum. Oh, yeah, these Roman people, Italians, you know.
Well, it is a museum.
They have written like that. I'm quoting from books, actually, not from my memory or my idea. They have actually said, oh, it's a nice museum. That's what it is. Come, I mean, you see? Yes, that's it. I was disgusted with the guide, in fact. When he told him he wanted to get rid of him. Because he came for money only, you see?
There was only one translation that to me had any spirituality, yeah. That was at the Assisi.
Huh?
At Assisi, St. Francis.
Oh.
There was more there. The rest of them were just commercially.
Well, what I mean is that it has done its work. My only point is that it has really contributed to man's progress. And its limit of giving more progress to the dynamic demand of man today has become very limited. And that can be seen by the Americans visiting, not foreigners who are not Christians. These are Christians visitors. What I mean is that profess Christianity. But they don't belong to Roman Catholic Church, perhaps, you see. So that's one division with which they start. And still there are people who, from England, found in the Episcopal Church, somebody who went to England. And somebody told him that let us go to that, to see the church. And he said the habit of going to the church for praying was so strong in me that I didn't like the idea of going to a church to see.
No.
You see, you go for prayer. You see, you go for inner, something to happen to you inside. And it says the habit was so strong that I didn't go there.
Mm-hmm.
You only to see, I don't want to go. If I go, I go for prayer. That's something. Well, but the attitude, I'm not saying this is good, bad. You see, this is human nature and this is the situation actually obtaining. So that when man wants something, well, he has to find what he, what can serve his progress, what can give him the life today. You see, that is what is wanted, and I think that one has to find out for himself where is the light.
Would it be a good answer to someone ask you, well, what's the difference between Christ, what he accomplished, and Sri Aurobindo? What is the comparison, and what would you tell?
Well, he said, I would say it is profitless to compare. Comparisons, as they say, are odious, is it not? Comparisons are odious, and in such big subjects.
Well, what would you say about what has been accomplished for mankind?
That we know. What is we other? You see, if what Christ said had been done, we wouldn't have many problems left.
Yeah, that's right.
But still, something has been done. In spite of all, failures of our human nature to rise to the demand of any great light. But something has been done. Awakening on a large scale, need for something great, or feeling for oneness, some sort of searching for the truth has been planted into human nature. Has become strong also by the adhesion to certain religions, all religions in fact. Every religion has contributed to making the faith in something divine, supra-cosmic, supra-physical, something greater than man, has fixed that faith. Well, that is one great service. Then it has pointed out avenues by which you can try to approach. Now, those avenues, whether now you can carry them out, how far they are applicable to modern life, all that is a question of detail. But they have certainly contributed to man's progress, to literature, to society, to even collective life, to individual life, to many people's conversion and change of life. Many people have, undergone radical conversions in their life. Men, women, and so on. So that is a great work done. Now what stands today before man is a still greater problem, because this wide dissemination of news, progress of science, material prosperity, international problems, then shaking of the world psychology by two world wars, all has so much upset the whole, you know, cultural life of man, that he requires something which will give him a rationale for believing in a great light, and also a path which can be available to all. Not a religion, a way of life, based on a view of life, you see? That is what is required. A new way of life based on a view of life. That life is a movement towards a divine consummation. And the way is to bring that light into life and turn life into divine light. Now you get some idea about it, you see? So that at least is something that is rational, which man can be talked to or given to, or at least you put it before them for what it is worth. And if they accept, accept, they reject, their choice, it's nothing wrong. It is the one that will reject, is it not? So we should be unaffected by what happens. What one does it that when one has known and seen or understood or thought or has got the conviction, he can put it to others. So if they accept, good. If they accept, good. Both good. Nothing wrong, because it's the one's business to accept or reject it. See, it's the one that will reject. So we have to be perfectly equal and say what you want to say with reason, with logic, and with sincerity. That's all. More one can do. Symbol of eternity. That is eternity. Eternal spring. Constant rejuvenation. Power of constant rejuvenation. That is its dynamics. Life, movement, and beauty, joy, delight. That's something of eternity. The one idea which 9 people out of 10 has got is sameness. No, not sameness only. Sameness of freshness, sameness of delight, sameness of beauty. That is eternity. One of the hymns of the Veda says, the dawn, goddess dawn, morning, you see. You are the first in the eternal succession of dawns that are coming. You are the last of the dawns that have passed. You see? That is sign of eternity. And they say, therefore, O eternal, you know, young girl, eternal young, come and awaken in us. They invite the dawn to give a dawn inside, you see, the morn, rise of the consciousness, awakening of consciousness, awaken us to the new, fresh consciousness.
That's sort of the symbolism of Christian baptism. I mean, it isn't the act of the baptism, but it's the
inner birth, yes, that's it. Idea is to give an inner birth. That is the Brahmin ceremony, thread ceremony, and so on. In every religion there was something that showed that there was an inner birth. Then it became custom and ceremony, died out, lost. So I threw my sacred thread away.
I was baptized, but I don't think it worked on me.
No. Ceremony afterwards, it's a custom. No, religions have...
300 long, yeah.
I spoke at Stanford when you were there, perhaps. And I told the boys, young people, that it has one important function to perform. It is marriage and death. On that two occasions, it has some work to do. So they have work. They have a work to do. The old religious organizations, old religious organizations all over the world, said that they will not satisfy the desire for concrete experience. Because religion, if it means anything, must mean concrete experience now. Otherwise nobody will take it seriously. It will be a Sunday affair where people dress nicely and go and talk shop and talk climate and come back nicely and say we are very pious. But there's nothing wrong in it, you see. There's nothing wrong in it. But as institutions, they have yet utility. It is, they can last. Social function is there, a marriage function, or somebody dies and is a ceremony. It's quite good. That's all that it can do. It's good. It's a social need which it satisfies. That other need, well, that is an inner process, and that all religions have, well, proved that that need of concrete experience for religious impulse in man cannot be satisfied by any religion. I am not talking of only one religion. All forms of religion have outlived their utility for inner life of man. If a man realizes something in his religion, it is because he has a special inner call. He would have realized it in any religion. It's not the merit of his religion. Mother said that in one of his talks. Mother's conversation, you'll see that. When somebody said that so many people realize why this religion, he said, oh, those people, they would have realized in any religion. Because they had this call and this aspiration and this desire to have a concrete experience, they would have got in any religion wherever they were born. It is not the religion that has a special merit of giving them the experience.
They take credit for it, though.
Yes, they would. I'm sure they do. If they can, they can trade upon it if they would.